Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, it's always a pleasure to talk to him, is music historian and writer Andy Neal. And we're talking about his massive history. Had me a real good time. Faces before, during, and after. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be back on.
Okay, now that I've read two books by you, you are fanatical for details and for background. It's amazing. I just want to say that if you're one of those people, one of those readers who really want a lot of stuff in your background, a lot of interesting stories and stuff like that, you're the author to go to because you really do an amazing amount of research for every book.
Well, I think it's important to do that because you get a much better understanding of the subject if you do include that detail. And so I find going the extra mile also helps to sort of clear up myths that have built up around various portions of the story, and it gives you a much clearer idea of the individuals as people, and also, you know, the times that they were working in.
Now, you write in the introduction to the book that you wrote this book about the Faces that grew out of a Ronnie Lane bio. Talk to me about that.
Well, there was a gap in the market, and there's still a gap in the market for a proper autobiography. No, sorry, start that again. There was a gap in the market, and there's still a gap in the market for a biography on Ronnie Lane. There hasn't really been anything that's come out. There's been that fantastic documentary, Passing Show, which was made by Rupert Williams for the BBC, which I strongly advise your listeners, if they haven't seen it, to go out and check it out. So Ronnie led quite an interesting life, and, you know, there was an equal amount of tragedy in his life as well. So there was scope for a book, and that's what the publishers originally wanted, and they had somebody lined up to do it, which fell through. And so they asked me if I'd be interested in doing it. And as much as I liked Ronnie's story, I felt I'd be better equipped to actually tell the whole story of the whole sort of Faces saga, if you like, not just the band when they were together with Rod Stewart between 1969 and 1975, but the things that led up to that and how they came together, because it's quite an interesting story and it's quite a tangled web that was woven that eventually all sort of connects up and becomes what we now know as the Faces.
It's an amazing story. And we're only going to talk about up until the time that they become the Faces this morning, because it is such a complex story. Just to review, the Faces are Rod Stewart, Ron Wood, Ronnie Lane, Ian Mac McLagan, and Kenny Jones. And they were together as the Faces for only 6 years. But before that, they were in a whole series of bands, two of which were incredibly important. And that time period that you write about is just so complicated because everybody's dropping out of bands, joining other bands, forming other bands. The 60s in Britain sounds like an incredibly complicated time in music.
A very incestuous time, too.
Yeah.
Because all these bands were rubbing shoulders with each other. They were playing the same venues, same clubs, and they would inevitably bump into each other. And the common thread that sort of threaded these guys together was their love of black American music, rhythm and blues, Pamela, soul. So, you know, in the East End of London, the Small Faces were getting together, and at the same time, up in North London, there was this young guy called Rod Stewart who was into the same music, and then over in West London, Ronnie Wood with his band were playing the same type of stuff. So inevitably their paths would cross many years before they actually became the Faces.
Well, let's talk about the early years for these band members. Ronnie Lane and is it Ken Jones were both EastEnders?
Correct.
What does that mean? I read your book, I know what it means, but for the benefit of the audience.
Well, I guess in America, if you're, say, a New Yorker, you know, there's people from Brooklyn, there's people from New Jersey. It's a bit like that. London is very territorial in a way. And the East End of London is very different, or was different in those days, and it is to an extent now, from, you know, another part of London. It has its own character, its own people have got, you know, a certain type of humor. They, you know, the accent's slightly different. You know, to an outsider, it would be difficult to pick up, but if you're a Londoner, you can sort of pick up the differences. And so the East End was also heavily targeted during the Second World War, because it was right near the docks. And, of course, the Luftwaffe, the German air forces, were trying to bomb that off the map. So it was, you know, it was triumph. It was, you know, in the face of adversity, people sort of try to pluck triumph from their hardships. And the Lane family and the Jones family, too, were sort of from that background. You know, they grew up, Ronnie and Kenny and the other members of the Small Faces, Steve Marriott and Jimmy Winston, who was the original member of the band, they're all from the same sort of area of that part of London. And, they grew up, like many kids did, in the shadow of World War II.
Now, you write, and this is true for many of the people in your book, as kids, they had an early interest in skiffle. And that's something that never came to the United States. Talk about what skiffle was.
Skiffle was like a cut-price version of rock and roll, if you like, but more folk-orientated, much more folk and blues, like Lead Belly songs that, you know, came from the 20s by the time they got to over to England. They were easy songs to play, and the skiffle boom really started in the mid-50s because you've got to remember, England was still experiencing rationing. So any luxury goods were very hard to come by. You know, even a cup of sugar was, or a banana, was considered like the height of luxury, you know, right up until the mid-50s, while England rebuilt itself after the war. There were so many deprivations, and so you couldn't go out and necessarily buy an electric guitar easily or a drum kit. So the next thing that was available to young kids who wanted to learn to play music was forming a skiffle group, and the figurehead for the skiffle movement was a singer called Lonnie Donegan, who took a lot of Lead Belly's tunes, like Rock Island Line, for example, and that went to number one in Britain and just influenced a whole generation of future British rock stars, like the Beatles up in Liverpool and the Animals in Newcastle. They all found that this was sort of like an economical way of getting into the music business. You didn't have to have any great musical talent, and you didn't have to afford proper instruments. You know, you could just do it with a washboard as a rhythm instrument, and a T-chest bass with a broom handle and a string as a stand-up bass, and even a basic guitar just to strum a few chords. And as long as you could get a tune out of it, you were a skiffler. And it was huge in Britain in 1956, 57, and it wasn't really until 57 when the Rock and Rollers actually started to come over to Britain, and you were seeing them in the flesh, and things eased a bit in terms of the import restrictions, and you could actually start to get cheap electrical instruments, that rock and roll really swept Britain. But before that, it was skiffle.
Now, Mac formed a skiffle group. Talk to me about the Mule Skinners.
Well, the Mule Skinners were a little bit later. They were formed in the early 60s. When the rhythm and blues scene was starting to, it was still embryonic, but it was starting to develop in London. And you had the Stones, obviously, and you had the Yardbirds and the Downliners sect, and all these groups were forming mainly in London. They were dissatisfied with the pop music that was being played, because as well as luxury goods being rationed, things like pop music were, it was hard to listen to. It was hard to even find on the dial in England. You had to switch to Radio Luxembourg, which was beaming a signal from Luxembourg, and they had the American Forces Network, and that's where you'd hear a lot of jazz and blues records. Of course, the signal would fade in and out, and that's how a lot of these guys, these rock stars now, when you talk to them, that's how they first heard the music, by trying to tune in to the wave band to hear this great American music, which was very, very cult at the time. And so people like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and Brian Jones and Keith Relf and Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page and Ian McLagan were these examples of these white kids from mainly London, although there was people like Eric Burdon in Newcastle who'd got into the same kick as well, who'd heard this stuff. And it was like a secret society, because hardly anybody was playing it and hardly anybody had the music. I mean, there's a quote somewhere from Tom McGinnis, who was the bass player and later guitarist in Manfred Mann, talking about how the music was so exotic and so rare in London that he took a bus journey from where he lived in South London over to another part of London and knocked on this guy's door, total stranger. He didn't know him, but he got this guy's address and said, "I hear that you've got a Muddy Waters record. Could I see it?"
Wow!
Just hold it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's how obscure the music was.
I know that Ian McLagan was influenced by Booker T and the MGs, you wrote.
That's right.
It's so interesting for us over here to read that and sort of try to put that all together. But it makes sense. This was an interesting time period. You write in the book that it's a time when Mercy Beat combos were supplanted by hirsute R&B bands. This was also the time of the mods versus the rockers, right?
That's right. It was all happening at the same time. It was all sort of a reaction to that sort of staidness and conventionality of the early 60s. That people wanted to break out from that, break out from the shadow of the wall, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And it was still a very grey, austere, stuffy Great Britain. It was yet to move into swinging London. And there were all these forces that were bubbling up, fashion, music, and the mod thing was part of that. And it all tended to explode in 1963, 64. I mean, in many ways, that was when the 60s really started, in Britain at least. Finally got people rebelling against what they'd been told to conform to, and the clothes changed, the music changed, the hairstyles changed, and all those bands were at the spearhead of that.
This is also a time when I read these your book, there are these managers in the 60s that sort of loom like mafia figures or something like that, and I'm thinking of Don Arden, Mr.
Yes.
Big. These people had an amazing amount of power.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was the early days of the music industry, and a lot of these guys were sort of like Colonel Tom Parker. They
yeah.
weren't really musicians themselves, but they were hucksters and hustlers, and they could see a way of making money with a minimum amount of effort by getting these entertainers, these young guys who wanted to be stars. And it harks back to the days of Larry Palms, who I think I discuss in passing in the book, who was very much responsible for almost like a conveyor belt of these singers like Billy Fury and Johnny Gentle, and he renamed these singers in these sort of glamorous American style names, who were just like young working class kids who didn't really have that much suss in terms of the business but wanted to become successful and glamorous and stars. And so these guys almost sort of saw them coming in a way and offered to get them on to the treadmill of becoming household names, by any means necessary. And of course, these guys were too busy sort of concentrating on their stardom to realize that other things were happening behind the scenes, and they weren't really getting what was due to them.
Well, let's talk about the Small Faces, okay, first, before we talk about the other big band. How did they come about? I know that there's a great story you tell in your book. I think it was Don Arden. How do you want to package them, looking good or unusual? And Don says, stick with the unusual.
That's right. Well, he knew that an unconventional image would get them noticed quickly. And the amazing thing about the Small Faces is that when they actually formed in the spring of 65 and up until the time they had their first record out that August, they'd only been together for something like 6 or 7 weeks before they were like on television, and their record was going up the charts. They were getting played on the pirate radio stations, and they were in the music papers. And that was really the power of Don Arden as a hustler. He had business contacts, and he also had other more, shall we say, shady contacts who could guarantee getting a record noticed. And these kids, Ronnie Lane, when the Small Faces started, he was only like 18, 19.
Wow.
So, they were absolutely shell-shocked by this in a way. And suddenly, they were going from just being just another one of hundreds of bands playing in their area around the East End of London to suddenly being on television and playing in clubs and around the country and getting asked for autographs. It was quite an amazing thing and almost like an overnight success. And it was very much down to Don Arden's skills as an entrepreneur.
Now, Ian McLagan joins the Small Faces. Their first album is very commercial. They had singles like Sha La La Lee, which I can remember when that came out over here. And by 1966, they have a grueling schedule of concerts and interviews. And eventually, they sign a long-term contract with, and this I didn't know, Andrew Oldham.
That's right, yes, because the penny had dropped, or the realization had dawned by the end of 1966, when they'd had like a year and a half of success. Practically all of their records had gone into the top 10, and they'd had two number ones in Britain, and yet they had nothing to show for it. There was no money coming through. You know, according to Ian McLagan, you know, they were never accounted to. They never got anything like proper royalty statements or, you know, proper expenditure accounts. It was all, they were paid a weekly wage of like 20 or £25 a week, and they had this nice house, a flat that they were sharing in a nice part of London, which was, you know, they thought was sort of subsequent to what they were earning, but in factual fact, you know, all of these sort of rock star accoutrements that they were getting, like being chauffeur-driven to gigs and having this nice house with a housemaid and a cleaner and everything, it was all being deducted from their you know, it was all expenses. It was all being deducted from their earnings. So, you know, after about a year and a half, they suddenly realized, hang on a minute, you know, we're working almost 6 out of 7 nights a week. We're on television all the time. We've had two number one records, and yet, you know, there's no money there. The pot's empty. So that's when they started to sort of want to get their affairs organized. And Andrew Oldham heard through the grapevine, because the music business was in Britain at that time was so concentrated and much smaller than it is now. So word and gossip would get around that the Small Faces were disenchanted with Don Arden, that they wanted to move to somewhere where they'd have more creative freedom, they'd be working less, because, you know, they were collapsing on stage and on television shows. You know, they were literally being worked like workout, you know, workhouse workers, you know, really being worked into the ground. And so they wanted to get off that out of that circus and off that treadmill and get into the studio and make records that they were more confident in and allow them more creativity. And Andrew Oldham had already set up the Immediate record label and had been going for about a year and a half by that point. And so he offered to take them off the hands of Don Arden, who I think by that point was sort of happy to get rid of them in a way, because they were becoming problematic. They were complaining all the time. Their parents had been to see him, and there's a famous story that he'd fond them off with the fact that they were using drugs, hard drugs, which of course was a smokescreen to take away from the fact that, you know, the money had suddenly disappeared, or it had been, you know, it couldn't be accounted for. So they sort of jumped ship from Decca and Don Arden, and Andrew Oldham paid Don Arden off, and they became part of the industry of human happiness, as Immediate Records was known, and they sort of signed up with Andrew in the spring of 67, and that sort of started a new chapter for them.
And that's when they released things like Ogden's Nut Gun Flake.
Correct, yes.
That's a classic album. That's a huge album.
It is. It was a number one album here in the UK, and it was had the gimmicky round sleeve, which attracted a lot of attention. But also, it was a testament to Andrew's faith in them to lock them away in the studio and come up with the goods. And of course, they had a brilliant engineer in Glyn Johns, who could translate a lot of what they were hearing in their heads and get it down on tape. And not just the Ogden's album, but the great singles they made at that time, Ichiku Park and Tin Soldier. So that was a really fertile period of creativity for the Small Faces at that time.
We're going to run out of time so fast. We're never going to get to talk about what I want to talk about. Now, the parallel track to this is another mega band, the Jeff Beck Group, which has Rod the Mod in it. Rod in it, Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart was known from the early times for his voice. His voice was really remarkable. He had a soul septet called Steam Packet.
That's correct, yes. He'd been discovered by a blues singer called Long John Baldry in
That's right.
Famous circumstances on a train platform. And he'd been a part of the steam packet. Well, first of all, Long John Baldry's Hoochie Coochie Men, which was the first group, and then they evolved eventually into the steam packet with Brian Auger and Julie Driscoll. And so Rod had cut a name for himself in the clubs, but they had no commercial success outside of that. They weren't a chart group, or they had no success in that arena. But when he joined the Jeff Beck group, Jeff Beck had been very popular as a sort of guitar hero in the Yardbirds. And so the Yardbirds were known in America. So when the Jeff Beck group started to record and started to set their sights on America, when they went over to America for the first time in the summer of 68, people knew who Jeff Beck was because of his pedigree with the Yardbirds. So they would flock to venues like the Fillmore and the Boston Tea Party and all those great underground venues that were such a big part of the gig scene in America in the late 60s. And lo and behold, they would hear this guy with this fantastic gravelly voice, you know, who could sing the blues, that could sing at the top of his range and you know, had a distinctive style, and he looked different with that sort of, you know, spiky haircut.
Yeah.
And so suddenly, as well as seeing this whiz kid guitar player, they're also coming to see this great singer.
I never knew this, and I actually own the album. While they were in L.A., Beck, Hopkins, and Stewart appeared on the Zappa album Permanent Damage, which stars the GTOs, the girls together outrageously. I never knew that.
Well, I mean, the Jeff Beck group were another band, you know, an English group that came to town, and the GTOs, as we know, were groupies, and
they
would get acquainted with them, and I think it was just like, oh, we're actually making a record tomorrow. Do you want to come down? And they had a day off, and it was just a lark. It's a bit like Eric Clapton playing guitar on Frank Zappa's We're Only In It for the Money. You know, I think they admired them because of their outrageousness, and so if they weren't doing anything, it wasn't such a great hardship to just come down and play on the recording.
Now, Jeff Beck was a difficult person to work with. You describe him as mercurial, obstinate, and uncompromising. About Hi Ho Silver Lining, Beck said it was like having a pink toilet seat hanging around my neck for the rest of my life.
Yes. Well, see, Beck wasn't a leader, really. Beck, I mean, he's followed his own path since, and, you know, he's very much carved out a niche for himself in the industry. But back then, you know, he was just the guy who played the guitar solos and all those great Yardbirds records. Keith Ralph was very much the leader, and to a certain degree, Paul Samuel Smith, who was the Yardbirds bass player, you know, he was the arranger and produced, helped produce a lot of the records. So Jeff was pretty much, you know, took a back seat in that band, and which he was happy with. When he left the Yardbirds, Peter Grant, who was the Yardbirds manager, and Simon Napier-Bell, who before that, said, okay, Jeff, we'll form a group around you. So Jeff wanted to have the best he could find and form this group, but he wasn't the natural leader. And Mickey Most, the record producer, who is very much working in the pop field, saw Jeff Beck as just another guy that he could make pop records with. And so Mickey Most had found this song written by Scott Weiss, who was a New York songwriter, called Hi Ho Silver Lining, and brought it back to England and thought it would be an ideal record for his new protege, Jeff Beck. But of course, it was like chalk and cheese. He made the record, you know, reluctantly. And of course, it was so commercial. And it's a sort of record that still gets sung at parties. And in fact, football teams over here, certain teams use it as their the tune that the teams go out on the field to, you know. So he, much to Jeff's chagrin, he is permanently lumbered with that record.
Just, we're going to run out of time, and I got to ask you about Rod. You talk about how his he has a passion for model trains. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, but he also has a passion for soccer. Okay. What's the story with his career with the Brentwood Football Club?
It's an interesting one, and the jury is still out in a way, because the research I did, I could never find any proper confirmation that he'd even played any games for them, you know, or had served an apprenticeship with them. I think he may have tried out for them, or he may have had intentions to join them, but you know, it was also, as I explain in the book, he lived up in North London, and Brentford is over in West London. and he didn't drive in those days, so it was commuting from where he lived in the family home all the way across London, you know, getting up early in the morning to get to the training ground. And I just don't think that it's as much a part of his story as it's made out to be. I mean, obviously football was a big part of the story. You know, he would play for a team called Highgate Red Wing,
yeah,
which was like his local team that his elder brothers played for. But I don't think he was ever a professional or on the road to becoming a professional footballer as much as his father wanted him to be. And of course, you know, whenever he had time off during his career, you know, as an unknown, and then going through to Jeff Beck and the Faces, and to, you know, when he became the megastar he is now, he'd always play football. So it was something that was part of him, but it certainly wasn't any part of his professional CV.
We only have like 2 minutes left, but eventually what happens is members of the Small Faces, members of the Jeff Beck group, form the Faces.
That's right.
And the people in the Small Faces had known Rod Stewart for a while because they had toured with the Jeff Beck group. And so and it sounds like the kind of scene it was at the time. Everybody was hanging out at places. I think you talk about Eel Pie Island, the
That's
club
right.
there.
That was a very important venue.
Very important. And it sounds like everybody's hanging out and everybody's getting to hear everybody else. So it sort of seems like it's not that much of a stretch that these two bands, which fall apart, would then the remaining members would meld together and form a separate group.
That's right. Well, they were known to each other before then.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, both Rod and Ron were fans of the Small Faces. So when Steve Marriott made his dramatic exit from the band at the end of 1968 and left the other three guys in limbo, it was also around the same time, coincidentally, that the Jeff Beck group were beginning to fragment.
Wow.
And so Ronnie Wood just called Ronnie Lane up out of the blue and said, like, oh, I hear you know, going through a rough time. How about we just get together and jam? And
it's sort of a lark.
For fun.
Yeah, a lark. And that was it. And the Faces were born. We're going to have to end it there. Trust me, this is just the introduction to the book. The book goes on for
part two and part three.
Yeah, we have to. This is a monumental book. My returning guest tonight is music historian and writer Andy Neal, and I have to say, the more that I read Andy's work, the more I want to read more. We've been talking about his history, Had Me a Real Good Time, Faces, Before, During, and After. We just covered before. Andy, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me too, Mark. Thanks for chatting, and I hope everyone gets a lot out of the book, as you obviously had.
Would you want to do a part two?
If you want to, I'm quite up for that.
Okay. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.